Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The 29th of July, 1981, Prince Charles marries Lady Diana Spencer. An 8-year-old boy watches the fairy tale unfold. An hour later, he's missing.
Then, one day in 2020, a BBC reporter gets a call from a mysterious source.
Vishal, the extraordinary true story of a boy who went missing while the world looked the other way.
All lives are not treated the same.
Listen to Vishal.
From global current affairs to art, science and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 1300 hours GMT on Monday the 17th of April, these are our main stories. A Russian dissident is jailed for 25 years after criticising the war in Ukraine.
This regime is not negotiable. You never have to trust them. And you definitely never should say, I'm a tired to support Ukraine.
We get reaction from the widow of Alexander Litvinenko, the Russian whistleblower who was murdered in London in 2006. We go to Myanmar in the grip of a devastating civil war.
The people of Myanmar ask me regularly, why is it that the world has taken such a coordinated response to the crisis in Ukraine, but not in Myanmar?
Plus, is snoring bad for your health? And the jazz pianist Ahmad Jamal, whose sparse playing style influenced generations of musicians, has died at the age of 92. There was an inevitability about a Russian court's judgment today in the case of Vladimir Karamurza. The opposition activist, whose joint Russian-British citizenship has been sentenced to 25 years in jail for treason and other charges linked to his criticism of the war in Ukraine. His wife, Yevgenia, predicted he would get the maximum sentence.
They hate him so much, and they're so much afraid of him out there, you know, running free, that they need to lock him up for a quarter of a century.
Last week, Vladimir Karamurza told the court in Moscow he was proud of everything he'd said. The former journalist and politician is the latest of President Putin's opponents to have been arrested or forced to flee the country. The Moscow judge said he would serve his sentence in a penal colony. He was also fined 400,000 rubles. That's just under $5,000. There's been widespread condemnation of the sentencing. I asked BBC Russian editor Steve Rosenberg whether this would make any difference.
I don't think so, no. It won't affect the verdict. It won't affect the appeal. Russia is used to hearing condemnation regarding its justice system, and it will brush that all aside. I was at the courthouse today in Moscow. I went along there with lots of other journalists, and lots of foreign diplomats were there too. Most of us were not allowed into the courtroom where Vladimir Karamurza was. We were told there wasn't room. Only a few sort of state-affiliated Russian media were let in, and Mr. Karamurza's mother and his lawyer. The rest of us were packed into another room watching proceedings on television screens. And, you know, very often in Russian courts, the reading out of the verdict by the judge and the sentencing can take quite a long time. Well, it didn't today. In just a matter of minutes, it was clear that the judge had found Mr. Karamurza guilty on all counts, including treason, and had sentenced him to the maximum possible punishment, a quarter of a century behind bars.
And, Steve, you're there. Is his fate an illustration of just how difficult it is to say anything critical now in President Putin's Russia?
I think so, very much so. I mean, obviously, the Russian opposition and critics of the Kremlin were coming under pressure before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February last year. Since the invasion, that suppression of dissent has only accelerated. And I think what happened to Mr. Karamurza today, this 25-year prison sentence, highlights how dangerous it is for any politician, any activist, any opposition figure to publicly criticise the Kremlin. I mean, he had been very active on the international stage, speaking out against the war in Ukraine, speaking out against political persecution in Russia, speaking out against the Kremlin. And it's not surprising that most of Russia's most prominent opposition figures have now either fled Russia or are under arrest or are already in prison.
Steve Rosenberg. Marina Litvinenko's husband, Alexander, was a Russian spy turned whistleblower who was murdered with a radioactive isotope in London back in 2006. Sarah Montague asked her about the significance of Vladimir Karamurza's sentence.
Because he receives this 25 years, it means he is a very special hostage. If it's a very valuable agent for Russia would be catched in the United States or in Europe, Vladimir would be a first person who would be might be asking for exchange. This is one hope for me and why he receives this just enormous sentence.
He's someone who has a British passport. What should the UK be doing? Because what we know so far is that they've summoned the Russian ambassador. We know that they've already sanctioned the judge in this case. What can they do?
Unfortunately, everybody who have a British and Russian passport need to understand. When you are in Russia, your British, American, any citizenship never be accepted. And Vladimir knew this. And when he went to Russia after even poisoning two times, he knew he would be charged as a Russian. But for British, I believe it need to be take a lot of and serious attention. Because is it just a very good example how Russia state looks now? For what happened to Vladimir, is this a punishment because he discredited of Russian army during this war in Ukraine? Is this revenge for what Vladimir did for last years when he provided Magnitsky law? And even more, they cynically put a judge who made this decision, who is under sanctions in the same Magnitsky law.
The judge has said it'll be 25 years in a strict regime correctional colony. What is that like?
It's absolutely horrible. It's not, of course, only dissidents. It's very high-profile criminals.
Will he be safe? And I ask this because in recent days we've been hearing about Alexei Navalny, who is very ill and it's thought has been affected by a slow-acting poison.
Vladimir was poisoned twice and after he recovering, but his health is a big issue and how he would be safe in this strict camp, nobody knows. And this is, I think, is a strong message to ordinary Russian people. They've been already afraid to go outside to the street, but after this, it would be just another scaring things for Russian people to do something against this war in Ukraine.
Marina, it is 17 years since your husband was killed. Do you have any hope that you might either get some form of justice for your husband's death or that Russia will end up in a better situation?
I don't want to criticize anybody for what not happening before, but it was not so much understanding for what this regime is capable for. A death of one person as my husband was crucial, but not enough to understand what might happen even worse. Now we're in a situation when millions of people now suffering. We have refugees, we have destroying cities, we have killing people, separated families. This regime is not negotiable. You never have to trust them, and you definitely never should say, I'm tired to support Ukraine.
Marina Litvinenko. The Sudanese Doctors' Union says almost 100 civilians have died in fighting now in its third day between the army and a rival paramilitary force. There's been sustained gunfire in the capital, Khartoum, and fighting has also taken place in other cities across the country. It's not known how many soldiers have been killed, but dead bodies are reported to be left lying in the streets. The conflict was started by disagreements over how to integrate fighters from the paramilitary force, Rapid Support Forces, into the army, who would then lead the combined forces and, in effect, the country, as Sudan has been under military rule since the coup in 2021. There have been international calls for a stop to the violence from across the world. Here's the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken.
We have been consulting very closely on the situation in Sudan. We've also been in close touch with partners in the Arab world, in Africa, in international organizations. There is a shared deep concern about the fighting, the violence that's going on in Sudan, the threat that that poses to civilians, that it poses to the Sudanese nation, and potentially poses even to the region. People in Sudan want the military back in the barracks. They want democracy. They want a civilian-led government. Sudan needs to return to that path.
The BBC's Mercy Juma has been monitoring the situation from nearby Nairobi in Kenya.
In Sudan this morning, the report that we're getting is, again, the people in Khartoum and most of Darfur woke up to a lot of gunfire and fighting and army and soldiers on the streets. Most of the people in the country are just holed up in their homes. They are afraid to come out because there's a lot of gunfire, and they don't really know where they are actually safe, because attacks have been happening even in places where people sought refuge and where they thought they are safe. So it's basically empty streets and a lot of army people and a lot of fighting artillery and gunmen walking around in Khartoum and Darfur, and people just waiting to see how the day unfolds.
We heard there that the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, says the US is very concerned and so are other leaders in Africa. And we understand regional leaders are planning to travel to Khartoum.
Yes, indeed. So it's not even only the US. This is something that has, you know, drawn attention globally in the region, outside the region. The African Union, first of all, has announced that it is sending the chairperson, Moussa Faki, to just travel and try to broker a peace deal between the warring groups. IGAD has also announced that it's going to send Kenya's President William Ruto, Salva Kiir from South Sudan, and Gwele from Djibouti to go ahead and also try to bring these people together and broker a ceasefire. We do not have details as to exactly how this will proceed. There have been talks of them leaving today, but the statement has been at the earliest possible time. So definitely they are still monitoring the situation and just seeing when will be the best time for them to go in.
So, Mercy, you say that people need to be brought together. You mean, I presume, the two generals, the one in charge of the army and the one in charge of the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces?
Yes, indeed. So we are talking about two army people here. There is General Al-Burhan, who is the head of the armed forces in Sudan today. And then there is also General Dagalo, who is also known as Hemeti. And this is the one that is heading the Rapid Support Forces. So these two leaders and their factions are the ones that are fighting. And they have been, you know, at loggerheads and going head-to-head with each other since the coup in 2021. And apart from these two, Sudan has been ruled or run by a council of generals. So what is happening is that there have been talks on how to transition the country into civilian rule. And the two generals, that is Al-Burhan, who heads the army, and RSF's head, Dagalo or Hemeti, have been conflicting on how that is going to happen, and most importantly, how the Rapid Support Forces will be integrated into the army run by Al-Burhan. So it's all about power struggles and who takes care of what and how the civilian transition is going to happen to, I would say, favor both people.
Mercy Juma. Now, a sound you don't want to hear at night. Well, apart from being annoying for anyone nearby, research suggests that snoring can cause significant decline in brain function. And that's not just because the snorer is tired. It's because it may cause inflammation and physical damage in the brain. Dr. Ivana Rosenzweig is the neuropsychiatrist who heads the Sleep and Brain Plasticity Centre at King's College here in London. And Sarah Montague asked her whether all snoring is bad for you.
No, of course not. So sleep apnea, which we suspect when someone comes to us and talks about snoring, is potentially serious sleep disorder, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any snorer has sleep apnea.
Right. And sleep apnea is what? When you effectively stop breathing through snoring.
Exactly. So where breathing repeatedly stops and starts during the night, and if the partner or the patient suspects they snore loudly and feel tired, even after full night's sleep, then it's rather likely they might have sleep apnea.
Right. And everybody's sort of known that you get tired from it because apparently you're constantly waking up to start breathing again. But your research, and we should say it's a small group, it was what, 27 otherwise healthy middle-aged men, showed something else?
Sure. So this is what we call proof of concept. It is an important study in a sense that we managed to find those very elusive, almost non-existent patients. We were very lucky and fortunate that our patients were so patient with us, because most of people we see in the sleep clinic already present with lots of other disorders, what we call comorbidities. So either high blood pressure or diabetes or obesity. So what we try to see, whether the traditionally understood concept that it is those other illnesses that cause problems and actually affect the brain is true, or whether this repeated stopping and starting breathing might actually have a direct impact. So the only way for us to do so was to find those patients that actually somehow we probably caught at the very beginning of the illness, where they were perfectly healthy, middle-aged men. So what we saw is that, especially in those with severe sleep apnea of higher severity, their way of thinking was decreased. They had a less well-developed spatial memory and short-term memory, and definitely deficits in vigilance and attention. What's interesting is that we also show they had decreased so-called social or emotional cognition, which is a relatively new concept for sleep apnea.
I mean, it's so bleak, this. Is there something somebody can do if this happens to them?
No, of course. So this is one of those positions where, as a physician, you feel ready and happy to say to someone they have illness, but illness that is treatable. So we have very effective treatments, positive airway pressure, mandibular advancement device, and there are new treatments which are on the horizon which could be potentially treating exactly these effects on the brain.
Dr. Ivana Rosenzweig. Still to come here on the Global News Pod.
Yes, you faced misogyny all the time. You faced comments. I had prominent members of political parties who shall remain nameless just letting the door go and closing it on your face.
We look at the role of women in the Northern Ireland peace process.
Exploring the events shaping our lives through original documentary storytelling.
We'll hear arguments for Roe against Wade.
The documentary from the BBC World Service is a window onto the wider world.
The security situation in Europe has changed in the last couple of years dramatically.
Search for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. More than 2 years after the military seized power in Myanmar, deposing the government led by Aung San Suu Kyi, the country is trapped in a civil war. Its economy is collapsing. The army increasingly uses the air force to attack insurgent-held areas. One such airstrike last week is believed to have killed at least 140 people. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head has been allowed to visit Myanmar for the first time since the coup. His movements were restricted to a limited number of places, and he was barred from contacting anyone in the opposition. Here is his report.
Inlay Lake, with its stunning backdrop of the Shan Hills, was one of the jewels in Myanmar's tourist crown. There are almost no tourists, driven away first by COVID and then the coup. Our boatman tells us we're his first foreign customers in more than 3 years. He talks about life after the coup.
We used to have freedom, he says. Then it ended so suddenly.
The collapse of tourism here has been catastrophic. The economy is in terrible shape, but it's worse than that for the people who live around here. They have an abiding loyalty to Aung San Suu Kyi. They're unhappy about the military takeover, although they don't say that openly. And they're worried that the armed groups which have been resisting the military have been operating closer and closer to the lake. What we need, said one of them, is peace.
Peace in Myanmar, though, is a very distant prospect. This was the border between Shan and Karenni states, to the south of the lake, just 2 weeks before we arrived. Ethnic Karenni insurgents have put up one of the toughest fights against the military. They're now supporting young men in Shan state who formed their own armed resistance forces.
We're passing through a village called Tantong, and we know that there was a clash between a volunteer militia here, anti-military, and the armed forces earlier this year. And a number of people were arrested. It was the first time they'd had armed clashes in this really popular tourist area, and it shows just how widespread this insurgency has become.
No one in Tantong Market wanted to talk about the security situation. One group of old men did complain to us about the lack of tourists.
Why don't the foreigners come anymore?
It's because of the bad political situation, they said, and because of him. And they pointed to the sky, clearly referring to the coup leader, General Min Aung Hlaing. At a silversmith's workshop on the lake, they're also struggling. Most of the glass display cases have been left empty. Above them still hangs, very prominently, a portrait of Aung San Suu Kyi, the now jailed democracy icon.
So I see you have a picture of Aung San Suu Kyi there. Does everybody like her here?
Yes, we all like her, said the workshop manager.
So are people sad that she's in prison?
I feel sad that things have changed so much since she's no longer around, she said. Really sad. Only one person agreed to be interviewed on the record during our visit. Mia A, a veteran political activist, was jailed right after the coup and released only last November.
After the coup, all hope in the people has gone. They were forced to choose the path of armed struggle when their peaceful protests were brutally crushed. If the right to protest was restored today, people would fill the street tomorrow. From experience, we know the people of Myanmar will never accept any kind of dictatorship.
The coup leaders had hoped to hold some kind of election this year to try to legitimise their rule. But there's too much of the country that they still don't control. Instead, they're now relying on indiscriminate airstrikes to try to grind the resistance down. The cost to the country, human and economic, is going to be high.
Jonathan Head. Well, Tom Andrews is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar. He began by giving his reaction to last week's airstrike to the BBC's Victoria Uwankunda.
The problem and the tragedy here is that because it is less and less safe for the junta forces to operate on the ground in Myanmar, they are taking more and more to the skies. There's been a significant increase in the use of fighter jets dropping bombs and helicopter gunships descending on villages. And when that happens, the casualties of citizens, of civilians, of men, women, and children, even young children, increase exponentially. So that is the trend that we're finding in Myanmar. And it's a very tragic trend, but it is not a surprising one. And I believe that, unfortunately, that these kind of attacks are going to continue.
And how so then are the people of Myanmar being widely affected by this? And also if we were to look at the region, neighboring countries?
Well, this is having a very destabilizing effect on neighboring countries. Hundreds of thousands of people have crossed the border from Myanmar into areas seeking safety for themselves and their families. These attacks are taking place on a daily basis. Over 1.3 million have been displaced within the country. And the country has fallen into abject poverty. More than half of the population of Myanmar now are living below the poverty level. 17.5 million people are in dire need of humanitarian aid. And one of the approaches that the junta has been taking is blocking access to these people so that desperately needed humanitarian aid are not able to get to where they desperately need to go. So the junta is using a variety of ways to attack and terrorize the people of Myanmar.
What are the ways that the UN are trying to find to solve this situation? What is the UN doing?
Well, number one, the UN has a capacity to deliver some humanitarian aid in the country, but there are many, many areas in the country that the United Nations does not have access to. There are a network of organizations, community-based organizations and networks that are able to get aid into these very desperate areas, and they're doing so. What they need are the resources to do so. The other, I think, critical thing is the member states of the United Nations are failing the people of Myanmar by not having a coordinated, focused, strategic approach to this crisis. There are member states that continue to supply the junta with weapons, knowing full well that these weapons are being used to kill civilians. That is completely outrageous. The people of Myanmar ask me regularly, why is it that the world has taken such a coordinated response to the crisis in Ukraine, but not in Myanmar? It's a very good question. Why is it that we continue to use tactics that we know are failing the people of Myanmar? I think we need to stop, take a deep breath, and change course before it's too late.
UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights for Myanmar, Tom Andrews. The former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is hosting a ceremony today to honor women who've been involved in the Northern Ireland peace process. She's awarding medals to former party leaders, Stormont ministers and other key figures. It's part of an effort to ensure the contribution of women is being fully recognized during the commemoration of the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed 25 years ago this month. Our Ireland correspondent, Chris Page, has been speaking to some of the recipients about how history has been kinder to them than some of their contemporaries were at the time.
We heard comments like, you women are in love with murderers, or you're Sinn Féin in skirts. So we knew we had a piece of work to do to make ourselves relevant and be taken seriously, because that's what women always have to do.
Monica McWilliams led the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition, a party which was formed not long before the peace negotiations began.
We have interrupted the culture of failure in Northern Ireland. There is no going back.
We were very much accidental political activists, but we started working really hard on both sides. That was the beauty of the coalition, that we came from people who identified as British-Irish, or both. Or neither. Women from rural, urban areas and all different income backgrounds. So it was a very diverse movement. So we felt we had a good plural group of people who had experienced the Troubles and had something to say about what coming out the other side might look like.
The deal signed on Good Friday 1998 was the main turning point on Northern Ireland's journey from conflict to peace.
I'm pleased to announce that the two governments and the political parties of Northern Ireland have reached agreement.
I kept nipping my leg just so that I wouldn't cry, but I just couldn't hold back. I just thought it was tremendous. It was a tremendous achievement.
Dawn Purvis was a negotiator with the Progressive Unionist Party, which she went on to lead for 3 years.
The politics of fear ensures that everything stays exactly as it is, that nothing changes.
Certainly within my own party, I always felt supported, but external to that, yes, you faced misogyny all the time. You faced comments. I had prominent members of political parties who shall remain nameless just letting the door go and closing it on your face. Things like that. Very disrespectful when you look back at how women were treated if they got to the floor to talk by other political parties. Some of the language, some of the abuse that was directed towards women assembly members or women councillors even was horrendous. I think, to be fair, that a lot of women who were involved in the negotiations have been overlooked.
One of the women who was involved in politics during the whole of the conflict was Breeze Rogers from the Nationalist SDLP.
I think if the women, when we started in civil rights, which was the beginning of people saying,
recognising that the way forward was political and peaceful and not through violence. And there were key women in that movement, like Edwina Stewart, who was a teacher from East Belfast and actually lost her job because of her position on civil rights. There was Betty Sinclair, who was again from the unionist community and stood up to be counted for civil rights. And there were different women along the way. I suppose the role of women like that was underplayed, I think, which is nothing new in Irish history, of course.
The ceremony hosted by Hillary Clinton today is part of an effort to change the historical narrative. The women she's honouring think that there has been a shift in perspectives, but also that prejudice is still present.
I don't think there's as much of that now as what there used to be in the mid to late 1990s. And I think it's because it was challenged, because women were more visible in politics. But we have a massive, massive way to go before we reach the point where women have equal representation and afforded equal status.
It didn't bother us too much because we weren't really in it for the glory. We were in it to see the thing working. 25 years later now, people recognise it. They also do not tolerate the misogyny that I had to put up with. So when you transform a society from conflict, that's part of it. You need to change those attitudes as well, that women are not subordinate, and they're not objects to make derogatory comments about. And I'm hopeful now that the next generation see that, and that's what equality is about.
Monica McWilliams ending that report by Chris Page. And now, Ahmad Jamal playing It Might As Well Be Spring. The celebrated American jazz pianist has died aged 92. A lifelong friend of Miles Davis, who said, "All my inspiration comes from Ahmad Jamal. His sparse playing influenced a generation of musicians, including Herbie Hancock and Keith Jarrett." His music was sampled by Nas in the 1994 rap classic The World Is Yours and continues to be influential. Jazz pianist, composer and broadcaster Julian Joseph gave his reflections to Sean Farrington.
I remember him as a very stylish, attractive, influential player whose music is just infused with indelible and incredible vamps and just really attractive, beautiful, influential music.
You see, a lot said about his sparse playing style, the ability to put in silence. I mean, how brave is that? How innovative was that?
It was hugely innovative, and it's become a real feature in the way, well, I say the way some people play, but a player like Herbie Hancock is hugely influenced by that. And it's it's an amazing thing. He has this mastery over time. It's almost magical, actually, that he can sort of delay the way he might play a phrase or just wait until that poignant moment happens and you can actually hear the groove in the bass and the drums, and you just wait and then you make your phrase work and all the more impactful. He was just a fantastic musician.
I wonder what do you think young jazz musicians, maybe what do you think you could learn from what he did?
Well, I've learned a lot from him in terms of how to interact with the band, how to be patient, how to pace your phrasing, how to make the most of something beautiful and connect that to the audience. Also, how to orchestrate at the piano in a way that is can be completely sparse and space-filled, or just massive, huge swathes of sound.
Julian Joseph on Ahmad Jamal, who's died at the age of 92. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop. The producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you.
the 29th of July, 1981, Prince Charles marries Lady Diana Spencer. An 8-year-old boy watches a fairy tale unfold. An hour later, he's missing.
Then, one day in 2020, a BBC reporter gets a call from a mysterious source.
Vishal, the extraordinary true story of a boy who went missing while the world looked the other way.
All lives are not treated the same.
Listen to Vishal.